This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
The rephrasing of the law itself is probably not that critical in the end, but there is a new atmosphere that we're all living in where national security concerns have come to the front. The fear, of course, is that it would have a chilling effect to make that sort of very important person-to-person interaction even harder.
Chilling effects is a term people hear all the time, in court rulings, in debates over content moderation, in dealing with online harms, or in news coverage of surveillance and legal reforms, which was the subject of the opening clip. The focus is typically on how legal rules may make speaking out, or speaking at all, more challenging, more risky, or even more dangerous. But what if our understanding of chilling effects actually understates the issue? John Penny is a law professor at Osgoode Hall Law School in Toronto and the author of a new book from Cambridge University Press called Chilling Effects: Repression, Conformity, and Power in the Digital Age. The book forces us to rethink chilling effects with significant implications for a wide range of digital public policies. John joins me on the podcast to discuss the book and what his findings mean for future legal and regulatory reform. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you've joined. You know, you've written an exceptionally important and I think incredibly timely book on chilling effects that I think is going to force many to rethink how we really think about chilling effects. It's a term people hear all the time. I was just recording a different podcast and it came up because it so often does in the context of some of the things that are happening today, whether it's in court rulings and coverage of surveillance or some of the debates that we have over content moderation. But I think, a central argument in your book is despite the fact that this term is so widely used, in some ways we've been thinking about chilling effects the wrong way. Why don't you get us started a little bit with, you know, what's the conventional understanding and what do you see as being wrong with it?
Absolutely. So first of all, I want to say, you know, thanks for having me on here. And it's great to have a chance to talk about the book with, your audience. You've somebody who's, you know, influenced my thinking on this. We've known each other for a long time. You've shaped my thinking. So it really is a delight to have a chance to talk to you about it. And for the people tuning in. So chilling effects has this dual nature, right? On the one hand, it's a legal concept. It's regularly invoked by lawyers, judges, but also journalists. It's forms part, as you mentioned, broader policy debates in popular culture. And in fact, if you do a search on Canly for chilling effects or chilling effect, it actually pops up over 6,600 cases, right, come up if you throw in these terms into the Canly database. So it's a concept that, you know, is increasingly being used, I think, to understand what's happening around us today. But it's not just a legal concept. It's also a concept that refers to a behavioral phenomena or tendency. That is, in the face of threats, legal threats, threats of surveillance, maybe threats of personal violence, we have a tendency to self-censor, to self-constrain our behavior. That is, these kinds of threats have a chilling or discouraging effect on our behavior. Now, the conventional understanding of chilling effects and the public policy challenges that it causes or implicates really comes to us from the legal concept itself. So conventional understanding of the concept comes to us from its legal origins. And it's, when I say conventional understanding of the book, the way we've been thinking about it, is the way we think about it as lawyers, the way judges think about it, but also as researchers, scholars, but also journalists and within popular culture. We all share the same conventional understanding. And it was largely shaped by its origin. So chilling effects came to prominence largely within US constitutional and the post-war period, a series of US Supreme Court judgments addressed overreaching McCarthy era statutes that were, you know, targeting what supposed communist threat within the United States. And the Supreme Court invoked the concept of chilling effects to strike down a series of these kinds of overreaching laws as potentially have a chilling or discouraging effect on people's constitutionally protected rights, largely freedom of expression protected on the US First Amendment. That legal origins have largely shaped our conventional understanding today, because that legal understanding largely was received in the Canadian law. Canadian judges and lawyers adopt it. It's also passed through and largely influenced popular culture. And the way we can break down conventional understanding, as I do in the book, it's essentially three different categories or three different features. So one, it's very individualistic, so it focuses on self-censorship. Of course, self-censorship is a big problem, but it's not only part of the problem. And what I argue in the book, it ignores the broader societal implications of what's happening. Secondly, it's largely legalistic, so often the focus is on a legal risk or a legal harm, in this classic example of a statute chilling speech. But most importantly, it's based on a deeply flawed theory of human behavior, that is, a deterrence theory. And the problem with both the legalistic side of things that I mentioned a moment ago is that the conventional understandings really cannot explain chilling effects in a broader other range of contexts, like surveillance chill relating to privacy threats and forms of threats or chills that are due to forms of personal abuse, for example. But when it comes to the empirical foundation, a big problem with conventional understanding is that it's based on this flawed deterrence theory, which has a very flimsy empirical basis.
Okay, interesting. And I want to come back to sort of some of those issues, especially with the social sciences teach us in just a sec. Before we do that, though, you talk about conformity theory of chilling effects, sort of drawing a little bit further from what you just described. And can you explain what you mean by that?
Absolutely. So the new understanding of chilling effects that I advance in the book is essentially this new theory. I say the best way to understand chilling effects is through the lens of what social psychologists refer to as forms of social influence: conformity, compliance, and obedience. That is, we engage in conformity for the same reasons that we are chilled and that we self-censor. That is, for self-protection and self-preservation. And so this is a behavioral tendency that's deeply wired. It's deeply ingrained. If you speak with an evolutionist psychologist, they will say that these forms of behavioral compliance, conformity, compliance, and obedience are all the same behavioral response to threats. That is, in the face of a threat, we tend to self-censor and engage in group conformity. Why? Because there's strength in numbers, right? So if you conform with the group, you're less likely to be alienated, more likely to survive. And those of our ancestors who didn't engage in self-censorship and group conformity in the face of a threat were less likely to survive. So this behavioral tendency is actually deeply ingrained in our psychology, I think, through evolutionary processes. And when you get into the research, I found that the truth, different factors that really cause and contributed to conformity also are the typical traditional scenarios that lawyers and people concerned about rights and freedoms often invoke concerns about chilling effects. So observation and surveillance, forms of uncertainty, personal threats and personalization, and examples where you have actors that have both power and authority. And so those, what I call those conformity factors, I argue, really are chilling effect factors. Now, just to be clear, I'm not saying that chilling effects are simply forms of garden variety social conformity, not at all. What I'm, in fact, they're qualitative and quantitatively different. What my argument is, to understand chilling effects, you have to look to the social science research to understand their impact.
Okay. Speaking of that social science impact, I mean, in some ways, I think it's important to recognize just how big of a shift this is that you're really suggesting, because as you mentioned, we've got a framework that courts and scholars have relied upon for decades, going back, as you suggested, the McCarthy year in the 50s. And it's built on assumptions of human behavior that you're saying, from what you've examined, social sciences have largely debunked.
Absolutely. So a deterrence, even though it's very popular, it's often the one invoked by politicians, like we're going to regulate this because we need to deter this kind of behavior. What the social science shows almost definitively is that while you can have deterrence, yes, people can be deterred by a law or deterred by a regulation, it rarely happens, or the specific conditions that you need in the real world context for deterrence to hold are rarely present. You need to have somebody who is aware of the law, aware of its requirements. They need to be aware of the risks or the legal risks of engaging in the potentially targeted conduct. They need to also have assumptions and awareness of the likelihood of their being caught if they actually engage in the conduct. And all these conditions, the research shows, are rarely present. Instead, you have this whole debate on amongst philosophers, amongst social scientists, about why people comply with the law. And it's questions of social norms, it's questions of moral legitimacy of the system. When you move over then to the concept of chilling effects, my argument is that the existing conventional understanding is based on this flimsy theory of deterrence. And instead, we need to look to those insights from social science, which, on the one hand, yes, it's about moral legitimacy and social norms. But in the context of chilling effects, these kinds of personal threats, it's a different kind of question. They have to look to specific areas of social science research, namely conformity, compliance, and obedience.
Okay, interesting. Now I know that a lot of the book grows out of some of your own empirical research. You know, speaking of the different kinds of research that's out there, and your Wikipedia study in particular, I think is a really nice entry point for some of this. You looked at what happened to Wikipedia traffic after the Snowden revelations. People, of course, will recall Edward Snowden and the surveillance, privacy-related, national security revelations that came out of that. Can you tell us what you found and how it links back to sort of what we're talking about here?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was a study that was actually originally a case study in my doctoral research, right? Which at the time was already focused on chilling effects, exploring in an online context in different ways. One of the areas that I wanted to study was the question of privacy-related chill. And what happened with the study in ways, it's one of these moments where you're thinking through studies and then you had this public event that happens that almost that changes the world and creates new research opportunities. So what I found with this, with my Snowden data, that's right, as you said, I looked at privacy-sensitive Wikipedia articles and traffic to them before and after the Snowden revelations. And what I thought was, based on a chilling effect hypothesis, was that when you had in June 2013, the Snowden revelations are disclosed. They're widely covered, first by the Washington Post and the Guardian, and then you had this incredibly intense media coverage of the Snowden revelations, which disclosed the likelihood that you had the US government and governments across the West engaged in mass forms of online data surveillance, right? And te surveillance of telecommunications. My hypothesis was that with people now aware of the possibility, even likelihood, that the government is monitoring what they're viewing and tracking and looking at and surfing simply, online with their web browsers, that they might avoid controversial, sensitive content. And Wikipedia would be a great way to look at that. They had data that was available that I could look before and after. And it's such a popular medium for information that you'd have a large data set, which I ended up getting. So what I found was before and after the Snowden revelations, in one part, something that I expected. If you were expecting a chilling effect, you would expect it in June 2013. The Snowden revelations come out, people read about it, are immediately like shocked and surprised. And then they avoid privacy-sensitive content during that month. And that's what I found. During the month and shortly thereafter, I had a statistically significant drop off of up to nearly 25% views or traffic for those articles over that month that was statistically significant. And you can pretty, as I have in the study of these graphs, you can see it in a clear way. But what I wasn't expecting was the longer term evidence of a chilling effect. That is, in the months following June 2013. Unlike the months leading up, we had more and more people viewing these privacy-sensitive articles on Wikipedia. Was that the months following the Snowden revelations, fewer and fewer views of those articles over time. That was consistent with a longer-term, more persistent chilling effect, which was deeply troubling because it meant that people were essentially chilled from accessing information about matters of a really important public policy, terrorism, national security on Wikipedia. And there's none of this content was illegal. These are Wikipedia articles, like encyclopedia articles online that people could read about, but they were avoiding. And the conventional understanding couldn't explain this. There's no legal risks here, nothing like that. Yet you have this longer term chill. And so the conventional understanding couldn't really explain it.
Okay, that's super interesting. Just to put a bow on this, the study ends up playing a role in actual litigation, the Wikimedia Foundation's lawsuit against the NSA. Just curious, how did that come about?
Yeah, so it's one of these incredible, sort of moments of coincidences in ways. I mean, on the one hand, you might say, when I actually published my findings in that study, it ended up getting a lot of media attention. It got picked up by the Washington Post, got picked up by the New York Times, Reuters International, Glenn Greenwald, blogged about it on The Intercept. So it ended up getting a lot of attention because I think it resonated because people were intuitively worried about the sort of revelations about government surveillance, and the findings resonated, like probably because many people were concerned and were avoiding sensitive things and searching for sensitive things online. So it resonated, and also because it meant that, democracy is in trouble if this is a reality. So I think some of the media coverage ended up filtering down into different institutions, civil society groups that were concerned also about the surveillance. But I can say that my participation in the actual litigation itself, I trace it back to one of my first sort of presentations of this research. I was at the Internet Work in Progress conference at Santa Clara in 2015. I was essentially just presenting these preliminary results to a group. It just happened that there was a lawyer from the Wikimedia Foundation in that presentation. And she said to me, "This is really important to something that we're planning. I can't tell you about it yet, but you'll learn about it, in the coming months." Turns out, months later, in 2016, the Wikimedia Foundation, along with the ACLU and a range of other civil society groups, launched a lawsuit against the NSA and the US government for unconscionable, unconstitutional surveillance that was having a chilling effect on the activities of the different institutions, organizations, and civil society groups. And the Wikimedia Foundation's hook in that was that you had a slide deck that Snowden had released that showed that the NSA had specifically targeted Wikipedia as a place that they would be gathering data and surveilling. My role in that was inevitably they got in touch with me to show harm. That is, in order to get into court in the United States, you have to show an injury. You have to show that if you're arguing a constitutional right's been violated, you have to show an injury in fact. That is, in some way, you're harmed by this illegality in a concrete way. And their argument was is that Wikipedia was harmed by the surveillance, and the way they demonstrated that was through my research. You had this chilling effect of Wikipedia users who were avoiding content on Wikipedia. Due to the government's, in their view, unconstitutional surveillance online.
That's very cool. I think one of the most useful parts of the book is the taxonomy that you offer. You've already talked about different kinds of chilling effects. I think it's probably worth sort of exploring or expanding on that a little bit here. So we know about the general sense with respect to deterring speech, but you talk about data breach chill and predictive analysis chill and system chill. Can you talk a little bit about how you think we should be thinking about some of these chilling effects?
My aim with this chapter, Taxonomy of Chilling Effects, is not so different to what Dan Solove attempted with his very famous and influential Taxonomy of Privacy, right? In his book, Understanding Privacy, published, I believe, in 2008, where his stated intention with that taxonomy was to promote a more pluralistic understanding of privacy, understanding the different range of threats, understanding how it plays out and its impacts. And I would say my aim here was quite similar, right? There's often the very classic examples of the statute or the regulation have a chilling effect that's regularly invoked, or forms of surveillance chill due to government surveillance. But what I want to do here is relating different activities, different forms to promote a better understanding of the scale of the threat, the scale of the impact. But also, my theory is evidence-based, it's evidence-driven, and that I provide these different subcategories and different examples in the taxonomy to understand different impacts based on the theory itself. So, let me give you a few examples. So, I have in there, of course, some of the classic forms of chilling effects, so concerns about, statutory regulatory forms, forms like surveillance and data collection, how, collection by, large-scale powerful companies, by government, can have a chilling effect, right? And I do so by drawing on the theory and the different factors, forms of surveillance, uncertainty, personalization, and power and authority. But I add other less familiar kinds of categories or nuanced subcategories of some of those broader ones. Like, for example, I mentioned data profiling and processing chill. And part of why I added that and discuss it separately from surveillance and data collection, although there's obviously overlap there, is that in earlier taxonomies, including in Dan Solov's original taxonomy of privacy, he talked about data processing. He said he was actually skeptical about a chilling effect. He was concerned more of a Kafka effect, that people would be uncertain about how they're being profiled with sort of digital personas and digital profiles within government. And it's that sort of feeling of helplessness was the real harm of data profiling. He's changed his mind, by the way. For I think some of the reasons that I set out in the book, I argue that today, with new kinds of algorithmic data processing, machine learning, AI-driven forms, and algorithmic profiling, you have even incredibly powerful forms of profiling, which create almost a kind of observation and surveillance, or form of observation and tracking that not even surveillance itself can match. Predictive forms of profiling, where you these systems can understand what you're thinking, what you're doing before you might even be conscious of it. So those kinds of processes today, even more so than, 10, 20 years ago when Dan was writing about these things, can have a profound chilling effect on behavior. But I also add less familiar categories, like, for example, what I call legal enforcement chill. I add that different from statutory and regulatory, for the point that where people are targeted by a legal threat, that's a really profound chilling effect. And some of the problems with the empirical basis for regulatory and statutory chill fall by the wayside when someone's targeted with a legal threat, then you have a real profound chilling effect and all the factors come into play. Or, for example, forms of personal threats and chilling, or the chill of personal threats and abuse. This is again an area that colleagues like Danielle Citron, Marianne Franks have written about. They've argued adamantly that these forms of personal abuse, personal harassment have profound chilling effects. And I think the research documents that. And that's often ignored by lawyers and courts in their reasoning. And I think that's largely due to a conventional understanding because it falls outside of the traditional focus on laws, legal risks, and the uncertainty within the system, which, of course, there can be chill from those kinds of threats, but often these other kinds of extra legal forms of chilling effects are ignored, and that becomes a real problem.
Speaking of one of the chilling effects that might resonate particularly in Canada, given some of the discussions we've had, has to do with sort of online abuse and harassment. You touched a little bit on this already. Now, in the Canadian context, as you know, there's been a lot of discussion around an Online Harms Act, introduced by the previous government. It failed to pass, and there's a lot of expectation that it's going to make some sort of return in the coming year. How would that fit within your framework?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is just to build on what I just mentioned a moment ago. I mean, part of why I do focus, and I have a few different examples, and I focus a lot on it in the book, is again, I try to be evidence-based, and the conformity theory, which is based on, this behavioral tendency, is about self-censorship and chilling effects for reasons of self-protection and self, preservation. What the evidence really shows, and I talk about this, for example, in chapter 8, I set up what I call the chilling effects curve. And that sort of aggregates a lot of data that I had collected within a study that has a few different scenarios tested. And what the data really showed is, while all these factors are important, the more personalized the threat, the greater the chilling effect. So if that's what the evidence shows, and that makes sense in light of the social science, which shows, we engage in conformity and are chilled for reason of self-protection, right? If you're in the face of a threat, you conform with the group to preserve, to protect yourself. So if the threat is more personal, whether it's a legal threat, a threat of personal violence that you often can have in cases of harassment and abuse, then the effect on the victim, on the target, is even more profound. And I give some examples from the book, like the example of Coles Whelan, who is a musician who was chilled, you know, not just in her speech, but she's essentially abandoned her music career as a result of this online stalking that she was a victim of, and that the courts really ignored in litigating over the prosecution of the perpetrator in that case. Or the case of Stephanie Feldman that I talked about in the introduction, somebody who was chilled from writing and publicizing her work from a coordinated online abuse campaign. So how does this play out in my framework? So I think I argue that these things have to stop being ignored. Harassment can't be ignored. There is chilling effects that arise due to this behavior, and the law can't ignore it any longer. But it also means that anti-harassment can be a hard case, because it means that laws that are enacted to regulate it and to prohibit it or prescribe it by law can themselves have a chilling effect. And this is actually my entry point to the debate. So I am supportive of anti-harassment laws or regulations that might curtail it, for the very fact that this kind of conduct can chill women, often minority populations that themselves are already marginal within democratic discussions, within freedom of expression, and being disproportionately victimized by online harassment, they're more likely to be targeted, more likely to be chilled, and less likely to participate. What I found in my own research, research that I've done with Daniel Citron, that anti-harassment laws, if tailored, if narrow enough, if done right, they can have a facilitating effect. They can send a message that we value the contributions of these of women and these marginal populations, and can encourage them to speak. While on the other hand, the concern about the chill of these statutes, like the deterrence theory that you have in other cases, it can happen. But in my studies, I found that it's more modest, more, I wouldn't say trivial, but more minimal compared to the more positive outcome. So again, it's not an a open, shut, slam dunk case, Michael. It's a hard case. We have to be careful. We have to be responsible and thoughtful. I think anti-harassment laws can be positive, but they can also lead to profound chilling effects if done wrong. So that's really where I come down on anti-harassment.
Yeah. No, and I think that's fair. Listen, I've been outspoken on anti-Semitism over the last couple of years, and I know that
absolutely
every time that I do, the amount of hate that comes my way could have a real chilling effect. I mean, continue to speak out, but you know, it's at times it certainly causes some pause and makes you question about some of the things that you might want to comment on.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it goes back to when I think through some of the jurisprudence on challenges to anti-hate laws. If you look, it really reminds me of the U.S. Supreme Court reasoning, where the chill of these kinds of threats of anti-Semitism, other kinds of hate and abuse, has profound chill on people speaking out and raising concerns of the chill and impact of these kinds of threats. And, you know, often the courts ignore that, and they're only concerned about the broader chill and impact of the law itself, and not how the hate and abuse chills people from those discussions from the outset.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Now, you've already identified what we just discussed as a hard case, but let's continue down that line just a little bit. You know, you develop a framework for precisely this sort of issue, these hard cases where the chilling effects compete with other kinds of claims. And so it's not an either or. There are real challenges there. You've talked about in the harassment context. Why don't we talk about privacy for a bit? It's another area that you've been really prolific on. Privacy advocates, you know, have been focused for a long time on issues around such as right to be forgotten, and talk about the prospect that it can reduce surveillance chill. But free speech advocates, whenever right to be forgotten comes up, talk about the chill that it may have in terms of access to information. So perhaps on that context, you know, how do you navigate that kind of hard case?
Absolutely. So the right to be forgotten, when it comes down to it, I think the devil really is in the details, how the right is operationalized, how it's done in practice. But as a broader theory, at least in principle, and I'll give you some example of how I think it could be implemented to navigate, I think, the balance. I think Exactly, as you say, the right to be forgotten is a great example of something where you have competing public policy concerns on both sides of this, but also competing chilling effect concerns. That is, you often see when people have proposed a right to be forgotten, there are concerns that the way it's operationalized, if it can lead to information being deleted and removed, the way it's enforced can have a chill on what people are willing to report on, what we're willing to say and to do online and offline. And I think those concerns are well founded and they need to be taken seriously. On the other side, of course, is that the right to be forgotten aims to also mitigate the chill of forms of data collection surveillance and reputational harms, right? The traditional concern where you might have a piece of information that might be incorrect about you, right? Defamatory information or simply information that has reputational harms for the victim. Maybe the victim, they might be a victim of a data breach where this information was actually protected and now it's out there and the internet is impossible to get rid of. So there's a whole range of circumstances where you can imagine information being about a person online and having reputational impacts and having privacy concerns. And the right to be forgotten, at least in most versions of it, provide a mechanism for addressing that kind of information. Some versions of it say that information ought to be deleted. Some versions of it make it more less prominent, more hidden in terms of other competing information. And I think what my argument on this count is understanding the fine balance here, right? So what I argue in the book is as the this being one of those hard cases is that in the framework that I set out is it's not a simply yay or nay. You say, here's you got a chilling effect, and so it's negative and you just got to deal with it. Instead, you have to take those four factors, the observation, uncertainty, personalization or personal threats, authority and power. You take those into account and understand the impact of the chill concern on both sides of the question or of the issue. You have to look at who's engaged in the activity, actors with more power, more resources, if it's the state or more powerful private entities, that's going to be a factor, which is going to push you one way or the other. But then I also say there has to be a synthesis. You have to look to other bigger questions about ethics, questions about less popular groups, so groups that are more marginal in society or disproportionately targeted. Within for forms of abuse or forms of targeting that can lead to the kinds of concerns that the right to be forgotten attempts to address, that also has to be a factor. And where I end up arguing to navigate these competing concerns is you take all those factors into account, you often need to come up with a balance. And I know lawyers, Canadian lawyers, love talking about balance, but I think here it really makes a lot of sense. Often when we talk about chilling effects, it's usually invoked as sort of a black and white concept that it's inherently a negative. But as some commentators in the symposium a few weeks ago and others have raised, that there can be, and I talk about in the book, there'll be cases where chilling effects can be a positive. It's chilling more abusive, antisocial conduct, for example, harassing conduct. Or in this case, it can lead to information that is harmful to a person's reputation, provides very little informational value, like less accurate information. Then this can be a case where if you have a tailored right to be forgotten, you can take into account and accommodate concerns about speech and expression and information circulation on the one hand, and privacy chill, it can be mitigated in the other. And the way I navigate it, say some forms of the right to be forgotten where information is not deleted and you don't have significant penalties. Instead, information is less prominent. So in a search engine, if you have different information results being response, you search someone's name, and rather than the defamatory or inaccurate information being the first on the search, maybe if it ends up being a little bit further down the second or third page where more accurate information is on the first side, that seems to be a more reasonable balance between the competing concerns. Rather than a form of the version of the right to be forgotten that leads to information deletion, that's going down a more troubling path for me.
You've identified now, at least in a number of different areas, some of the ways to think about some of these issues and how we can navigate some of the challenges. The book itself does I think a really great job of identifying a pretty comprehensive reform agenda on some of these issues? Can you, I guess continue down these same lines? What are some of the kinds of things that you think we ought to be thinking about or doing when it comes to this stuff?
Absolutely. So, a few things. And the first point that I make in the book, and then a key, contribution of the book, is that in order to deal with I think the serious public policy challenge of chilling effects today, with all these different threats and how they're being increasingly weaponized against us, is a better understanding of the threat. So I advance this new theory of chilling effects and give these kinds of things. We need to set aside the old conventional understanding, needs to be set aside, discarded. And we knew this, we need to open our eyes and understand the concern, the challenge, and the threat. And that's a key, I think, step to get there in terms of what to do as a response. Secondly, and I think this is an easier response, I think the skepticism that you see that's often pretty pervasive within the law, amongst judges, amongst lawyers, legal scholars, about less traditional forms of chilling effects. So the chill of forms of surveillance, the chill of forms of harassment and abuse that you often see ignored or downplayed within judicial and legal reasoning. I think that has to be discarded too. I think lawyers, judges, policymakers now to open our eyes and not only be less skeptical, but be more open-minded and flexible and allow reasonable claims of these kinds of chill within court, but also when thinking through public policy reforms. So those are, I think, really simple changes that can be done, and maybe greater recognition amongst judges, judicial notice, not asking for, increasing really high barrier for very specific evidence of chilling effects, when I think the social science, when you combine that with the growing body of research that I detail in the book that documents chilling effects in a wide range of circumstances, when they're combined, I think the skepticism has to go, and more judicial openness and legal openness has to be the pathway going forward to vindicate individual rights and victims within court. That's a simple solution. But as you hint at, the bigger argument that I make in chapter 10 is more comprehensive reforms. And, fortunately, with the theory, the way I structure those reforms is around the four different factors that I set out, the four chilling effect factors. And in order to address a public policy challenge, I argue you need reforms on each of these counts. And I don't need to go through all of them, but on the one hand, surveillance and observation, my argument is pretty simple. We need to restrict and significantly curtail the forms of surveillance within society by powerful entities. So I'm talking about by government, and we need to think innovative ways of about data collection and large-scale surveillance by powerful corporate entities as well. So I think new data protection legislation, new privacy legislation that's robust, can be enforced, that's all important. When it comes to uncertainty, we also need, I think, really robust transparency laws, transparency within government, transparency within industry, and it has to be mandated, right? So I think where citizens have a better idea what data is being collected for, the reasons for it, and not just that, how are these new tools and powerful technologies that we're learning about, hearing about, how are they being used in government? How are they being used by industry? And I think transparency is a really simple way to reduce the chill of uncertainty with a lot of these practices and the broader public policy challenge. Then I get into forms of personal threats and personalization. That gets into the reality that I think that we need robust anti-harassment laws, hate speech laws that are, thoughtful, tailored appropriately, given these can be hard cases. That has to be part of, I think, the solution. And I think there's other ways that some of my colleagues in the United States have advocated. So forms of duties of data loyalty that might be imposed on platforms, not so different from, Jonathan Zittrain's and Jack Balkin's concept of information fiduciaries, that maybe larger responsibilities or duties can be imposed on platforms in how they're handling information. I know this is somewhat part of the Online Harms Act, but I mean, that's a deeply flawed act. There are better ways of doing it. But I think these could be part of the solution too, to reduce the abuse of data collection, just collecting at scale, often for no reason but to collect the data and find uses for it later. I think that's a big problem, and there are ways you can deal with that kind of personalization concern as well. And lastly, we need to deal with power and authority. That means ensuring that government is constrained by robust laws, whether it's privacy, whether it's forms of regulation of how government is using these technologies, forms of restrictions about like surveillance technologies that I mentioned in chapter 10, within the law enforcement context, where I think the chill can be really profound, but also thinking about power within industry. So anti-competition law, antitrust law reforms there, that has to be a part of the conversation too. I realize I've been going on for a bit, but I think these are just some steps. It's more comprehensive what I said in the book, but I think it has to be multifaceted. There's no one magic bullet here that's going to solve this. There's a lot, but I think there's a lot to be done.
Okay. You know what? I mean, that's a great agenda. It's an ambitious one, but yeah, at the same time, just about everything you touched on are issues that are currently being discussed by policymakers. They've been a part of the debate. And if I have to say that at times, much of that debate, some of it is now longstanding, has been missing some of the kind of new thinking, some of the sort of evidence that you bring to bear. So thank you for the work that you did in pulling this together. The book's really exceptional. We'll have a link to it in the show notes so people can get a copy for themselves. And thank you for joining me here on the podcast.
Michael, thank you so much for this great conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at lawbitespod or follow Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening and see you next time.